Football on Off the Ball.
It's the producers in football form. If you're really going to mess up a football club, how could you do it better than this? I just don't think you could.
Join in the obsession.
Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
We're very happy he's made some time for us. Eddie Jordan, you're most welcome.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Nice to have a chat in these difficult times.
We have tried to nag you for a chat at various points over the last number of years, and in the main, you are far too busy. So less busy, I would presume, now.
Well, yes, of course, everybody is less busy, but this is a great opportunity to catch up on things that maybe we haven't done or wanted to do or put aside for many years. There was also another aspect that, obviously, working with Channel 4 and various other people, there was a conflict. For whatever reason, these people don't necessarily like you jumping from one station to another. So I won't take all of the blame on not being available. I'll just take some of the blame.
How are you?
It's a very handy excuse at the time, I have to say.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Yeah, I'm sure it is. How are you using the free time now?
Well, I'm online every morning early to do my Pilates, which is 1 hour. I'm really pretty much focused, dedicated to that, because as years roll on, I think people are inclined to either become more lethargic and doing less things, certainly in sport and activity and looking after their own body. And I include the mind in that as well. So I cycle a lot. I meditate a bit and think about things a lot and try to think how I could do things better or how I should have done things better in my past, or analyze my mistakes, where I failed or where I thought I could have done better. Those sort of aspects, I think, this is a wonderful moment and we mustn't miss this opportunity to be able to analyze what are we doing, how long are we going to be on this planet for, how can we make sure we leave this planet in a better way than we came into it, because we have obligations to our families, to our children, our grandchildren, and so forth after that, that we have to do the maximum we can to give it the best opportunity while we're on this place.
Have you always been reflective in that way?
Actually, no. I'm a more visionary kind of person. And I still am. I'm thinking about my life in general, whether it was in sport and different activities. Once I achieved or felt I was coming close to achieving something, I have a habit of discarding it or handing it on or making sure that, you know, that there are other people to handle it. And I'm thinking about the bigger picture further on down the road, or the next different plan of attack, or the next opportunity, whether it's business or it's family or it's home. I mean, it conjures up so many different aspects. That really is, if I was to analyze myself, I would say that I'm not a visionary as such, but my mind is always in the future, very seldom in the past. And as soon as I feel that I've got the best out of something that I possibly can do, I sort of give it on to somebody else to make sure, you know. Delegation has always been a huge part of my life, and I always felt that knowing the right person to delegate to, then it gave me the comfort to move on.
You've always been health conscious from what I can see. I saw old footage of you at your Oxford home. There was a BBC reporter there and you were out for a jog at 7:30 in the morning.
That was actually, if I remember that particular case, I was only to try and get Eddie Irvine to get out and do something, because he used to sit on his butt all day in his apartment. He was the laziest driver of all time. And it's a shame, because he could have been a world champion so easy. But, you know, that was his style. He was a nightclub guy. He didn't really wake up till 12 o'clock in the day, or even later sometimes. And my attitude to him was that I went out and I remember hiring, I didn't really want to do this, but I hired a teacher. Who used to look after my gym classes every 3 times a week. And I said, look, Barry, will you please come and try and sort this guy out? So I intimidated him into almost embarrassment to make sure Irvine would be out running on the streets in Oxford. But I often wondered whether he was actually only on the way home from the clubs, or he was actually had just got up. But anyway, that was Eddie Irvine. He's a different kind of animal, I can tell you. You know, but he is. Honestly, he was hilarious to work with, but very infuriating, I have to tell you. He used to drive me around the twist. And but then that's the way life is. Sport kicks up all sorts of wonderful characters and wonderful great stories all the way through life.
So Irvine got by in his talent as opposed to diligent hard work day after day.
Well, it certainly wasn't his fitness, and it certainly wasn't his upper strength. But, you know, he had a very cunning way of doing things. And on reflection, you know, he was probably one of the cleverest and the smartest people, not by education, but by just guile and intuition, that he had a great ability to know where he was, how to maximize it. I'm talking about not just motor racing, but I'm talking about in latter life, you know, his ability to make money, his understanding of when the best time is to move in and move out of things. He has an uncanny knack of seeing the position that's in front of him and taking full value out of it. So he was particularly, you know, now that I remember him really, really well, I used to be so annoyed with him, but I can see now his modus operandi, how he operated and how he went through life. And he's a carefree guy, you know, that was the way he was.
Are you carefree?
I'd like to think I am, but probably not in the realms of the Irvine. I mean, he was a different. I'm carefree insofar as that, you know, there were different things that were important to me. Having a family and children and grandchildren, that was important to me. And with Eddie, you know, yes, he has a child from his days in Macau, and funny enough, my wife is Marie, and his wife is Marie, and his daughter is Zoe, and my daughter is Zoe. I don't actually understand the logic and all of this significance, but, you know, there was a number of things that Eddie was very close to the Jordan family, and we were very close to him. And so I don't want to just single him out in particular. That would be wrong, to give you the impression that there was no one else, but there was lots of different drivers, of course, who came along. But Eddie Irvine was a carefree character, and I would have liked to have been as carefree as him. I felt much more responsibility, and the responsibility not just was, as we've discussed, about family, but we've, you know, the team, the numbers of people inside the team, how I could pay them, and then how I would look after, you know, they had responsibilities of staff to their children, to their going to school. But then there was another added concern, and that was the suppliers. You know, there was maybe on Jordan Grand Prix, whilst there was only about 300 or 400 people working at the maximum at Jordan Grand Prix at the time, there was probably several thousand people responsible, or I felt responsible for all of those people.
Because for younger listeners, it might be extraordinary now to think that there was this Irish team from 91 to 05 with an Irish man at the helm of it, and Eddie Irvine coming through, and it was just an exciting time, and the yellow car and the rock and roll vibe. It could all lend itself to looking very carefree. And yet I'm sure for a lot of those 14 years, you're thinking about, as you said, paying staff, paying suppliers. It's not that you're just flush with money and it's falling from trees.
Oh, no, I was the biggest blagger on earth. And we used to have very, very great opportunities. You talk about the rock and roll image. But that was in me. I always had that Irish, I love music. I have a band, Eddie and the Robbers, and I play a lot. That's the one thing that keeps me in my more recent years, things that keep me really focused on what I want to do. And, you know, for an hour a day, I go on to Roger Taylor's class, Roger Taylor from Queen. So I do all his classes. And he lives not far from me here in Cape Town. So I'm a big fan of Roger's, of course. But, you know, the whole music scene, and then link that to a motor racing environment, and particularly Formula One. So many of the great people of motor racing, so many of the great people of music, they, for some reason, there seems to be a magnetism towards each other, much more so than anything else, no more so than rugby, more so than soccer or various other sports that are important. But motor racing seemed to gravitate and seemed to annex themselves. Now, you could say it was because of money, it was because of the flash, or because of this. I can't tell you really why. It just was there.
Yeah, because for Jordan, I mean, in your first year, you finished fifth, which is, you've described it as a miracle, and it must have felt that way. And then, you know, the peak in 99 was third. These were incredible results. If you had to kind of pin down the secret to Jordan's success, given where it was coming from as a massive underdog, how did it manage to punch above its weight so massively, particularly around that period?
Well, it obviously, you know, a lot of people seem to talk about this particular era, but it happened long before that. And it's all about, and it has the same understanding, and we talk about people about motivation, and we talk about belief and how much people must believe in themselves. It took me a long time. I felt I was born just after the war, and I must tell you, as an Irish person, I felt inferior. I had an inferiority complex when I went to England. I always thought that the European drivers, the British drivers, and the people from all over it would be better than me. And it took me a while to come to terms with that. So if we put that to one side and now come back to what your question was about the times, I mean, they were heady days at the time. But, you know, I was a bit reckless. I probably still am. And reckless in terms of my view, I always felt that I could get the money. I'd always felt that I had the inner belief in my own self, that I was given the, if you like, the requirement to find the necessary money for the team to survive, to be able to develop, to be able to advance in terms of its position on the grid. And a lot of this has to do with talent, it has to do with people, it has to do with money, but it has to do about motivation. And it's how you create that motivation and that somewhat, you know, arm around the shoulder. And I know it sounds a bit of a cliche now when you see different footballers in different other sports, how they motivate the group that they have going onto the pitch. I'm intrigued by that because I like to see different people and how they actually operate. Some people are very vocal, and some people are very calm, and some people are very quiet. It just depends on how the team, a group around them respond. Now, in my particular case, there's a lot of fragile egos in our business, particularly at the high end of the engineering staff, the people who design the cars. They have no idea and don't ever want to have an idea about money. So what the must thing is, that any engineer or designer or creator of any particular thing, you must never give them a checkbook. You never allow them to spend because they will absolutely bankrupt you in a flash. And then you're down the pan. And there's no point being a bankrupt hero. There's too many of those. You know, it's too easy to say, yeah, okay, spend it and think about it. But you have to be focused. And I was a real bastard. I used to hold back 10% of any monies that we got because as sure as anything, I knew we'd want to develop new things as we were going through the season. I knew towards the end of the summertime in August when there was always a sort of a kick on. So you try and do well at the end of the season. So if you notice, you know, the situation when we won in Brazil, it was at the end of the season. When we won in 1-2 or whatever it was in Spa, towards the end of the season, the same in Monza. And I think France was probably the difficult one because that was in the beginning of July. But we just never really got ourselves together early enough. And it took us a while to be able to, the effect of the money, the effect of the talent that we had, the effect of the design, understanding the design, because actually understanding what the car was. And inevitably, we nearly always had very young drivers, drivers who would bring to us money, which was so important to us. But it also took them some months and some races to understand how best they could get the maximum out of the car. So if I was to think about it going backwards, I would probably change things because we needed to kickstart quicker. We needed to kickstart earlier, and we probably needed more experienced drivers, to be very honest. But you know, we as a team were very inexperienced, so it actually probably suited quite well.
Yeah, and I don't know if you pioneered it, but certainly it's something associated with you and with Jordan. Those young drivers, whatever way you picked them, and I'm sure the money they brought was a factor, but you seem to pick drivers who went on to have huge careers.
There's a story that Irvine tells everyone. He said Jordan would have been bankrupt at Ferrari, but you know, the truth is that Stefan Johansson and Jean Alesi and Michael Schumacher, Irvine, Barrichello and Fisichella, all six drivers came from me to Ferrari. But there's no secret in that. I mean, Ferrari were the only ones who could pay the top dollar, and I made sure I got the top dollar on each occasion. So did I fleece them? Of course I fleeced them. And that's what they were there for fleecing, and I gave them the best drivers. I created the drivers. I mean, who on earth would have picked Barrichello as a young 18-year-old, 19-year-old Brazilian driver? And the only reason I did do that was because Ayrton Senna had told me, listen, you better keep an eye out for this guy. And so invariably, where I got very lucky, I always was a pretty much conversational. I would go out and use people and contacts and names, and all the time being inquisitive for trying to find out what I thought was going to give me the best opportunity to do well in races, whether it was to try to win them, because I wouldn't want people to think that we won a lot of races. We didn't. But what we did do is, yes, we did punch above our weight. And I love the fact that we were carefree. And you, coming back to what you said there earlier, in a way, I used to put on, if you like, a facade where we didn't care. But deep down, I can tell you there was a steely, steely grip on everything inside the Jordan team. They understand what I was playing at. And I used to get Ian Phillips, who was the head of marketing and head of the press. He said, Eddie, look, sometimes you're going to have to calm down a touch on this. I said, no, Ian, this is working. This is working. And he actually came along and he was a brilliant guy in terms of encouraging me to that it was okay for me to do this, but as long as the people behind me were all so strong, so believing in what could happen, and a different focus and a different belief as well. But I mean, I had the belief right from the beginning. You couldn't possibly, you couldn't go into any kind of a sport unless you have the real belief, because you get gobbled up. There are so many really talented people around, and to succeed against those people, you have to have a different kind of a concept. And in our case, where we didn't have the money, we made up for it by being debonair, you know, Jack the Lads, Irish, different things. And we always had scams or something on the go. So that encouraged us all to enjoy it. And we did enjoy it.
Was Michael Schumacher's talent just unmistakable?
Well, you say that because there were a couple of things that were, we talk about being fortunate and being in the right place at the right time. And that certainly was. I often say that there's never been, I've never known anybody as lucky as me. And I mean that in the best, nicest possible way. I just was dealt a very good set of hands, cards in the hand. Michael Schumacher, I have a little issue with Michael. And people often say to me, who's the best driver I ever had? And, you know, we talked about friends and we talked about Fisichella. We talked about Barrichello and Irvine. But we left a couple of people out, Johnny Herbert, who won a championship with me, and Alessi. But the very first one was when I gave up driving. And in 1982, I took on a young driver. And I brought him to Macau. We gave him his first ever drive in Formula 3. And then went to Macau with another team, with the Marlboro team. And we won there. He changed his name. And he drove from there on in. He drove in Formula One, and his name was Ayrton Senna. So people don't often reflect or remember that Senna started with me, just like Damon Hill did, another world champion, and then Michael. But you put them all together, and if you're asking me who do I think was the best driver, because I think that's what you're referring to when you talked about Michael's talent. Of course he had outstanding talent, but so had Senna. And it's always a really difficult call to know which of the two of Senna. And I'm usually one who causes some consternation or chaos with this, because I believe neither of those two were the best drivers that I've driven against or been part of. And I always come back to Alain Prost. And people kind of say, what? Is he being serious? Mm-hmm. But, you know, the thing is, Alain Prost won 4 world titles. He lost one by half a point. He lost another world title by a point. But what I liked about Alain, he stood the test of time. He now works with us. He's on the French television. I'm working on a British television company as a Grand Prix. And he's still the same guy. And we were in a team in 1979 with the Marlboro World Championship team. He was a young kid there like me. And what he achieved, a young Frenchman at that time, is amazing. But the one point that comes out for me stronger than anyone else, he never minded who his teammate was. He was a team player. And when I reflect back on all of the contracts that I had to sign with Ferrari, with the great Michael Schumacher, no doubt about his outstanding talent. But he lets himself down in one area for me. And that one area was that in every contract that I signed with Irvine or Barrichello or whoever they were, there was a clause there that they always had to play second fiddle to Michael Schumacher. And I just wish, for his own, for my belief, I want him to be the best, but I can't. And the reason I can't was because he manipulated people's contracts. And if you remember different things when he you know, he was passing people, and I forget the young Brazilian that he was passing, and said, he is faster than you. And it just sticks in my mind. And, you know, I just feel that somebody who had the most unbelievable natural talent, in a similar sort of level to Senna, people had more of a love affair about Senna because they wanted to believe he was the best. Probably Michael was the most talented, but for me, the best driver I've seen in the time, say the 30 years that I was around the thing, for me was Alain Prost. That's probably going to change very shortly because I do feel that Lewis Hamilton has achieved all of those things. And okay, in a different era where there is a monopoly, the car is just quite simply staggering. But nevertheless, he's maximized it. So I would say by the next couple of months, if there is a championship this year, we'll see yet another world champion achieving 7 world titles. I think Lewis Hamilton has every chance to be the greatest driver of all time.
Coming soon to your Off the Ball podcast feed.
I'm nervous. Police will use tear gas.
Yes. Oh, Jesus.
You're looking at two of the best professional wrestlers in Mexico City.
Saying we won after your team's won a football game is like saying I had sex after I'm watching porn.
So if you hear anything about the Gringo Loco, that's me, okay?
We were on our own at 3,600 meters.
We have that mark as narcos, cocaine, violence, as a Pablo Escobar thing.
To be honest with you, if I never see Route 40 again, I will be a happy, happy man.
Diverted, a 10-part Off the Ball original series telling the story of sport and other things all the way through Latin America.
I thought Route 40 was the most lonely road in the world. Turns out Route 25 is somehow even lonelier.
Available soon for free on the OTB app.
On Senna, he seems like, and I'm basing this a bit on the documentary, to be honest, but he seems like just the most incredible cocktail of charisma, sensitivity. He's a profound thinker in some ways. He's belligerent in many other ways and a tough customer. Utterly kind of compelling. Did you like him? Did you love him? Did you have a good relationship with him?
His name is Ayrton Senna da Silva. So when I met him, he was in Formula Ford. And I had one who was a talent scout. That was the way I went about it, just like they have in football. Nobody does that in Formula 1 or Formula 3, Formula 3000, but I did. I needed people to go around different races for me. And constantly everyone's coming back and said, "God, you need to see this guy, da Silva. He's quite special." So I went to Snetterton for my own eyes to see him. And I remember picking out a point on a particular corner, which was a very difficult corner. And I had in my mind exactly where that little piece was. And each and every time he came around the corner, he hit that particular, his tire, his inside front left tire, which was the one that was catching the grip. So in other words, he was coming in at unbelievable speed and he touched this every single time. And I realized then that this guy was very talented. Obviously, we gave him the drive and I liked about him as soon as he'd had the test and he went off to do something else, he wrote me a nice little note. It was one of the very few things that I have kept because he wrote me a note to say how pleased he was and thank him. You know, I didn't charge him for the thing, which I normally would do, but he was that talented. We kept close together. Then I took Brundle and he went to drive for Dick Bennett's, but we came together to do Macau and a group of us, and he won Macau. So, you know, he had strange. We knew his first wife really well. My wife, Marie, and his wife were friendly, not pals, but, you know, they knew each other at the paddock and stuff like that. And they hung out before the race, and everyone was getting uptight about the anxiety of what's going to happen in the race and stuff. So, he was compelling. You know, there was all sorts of rumors. Was he bisexual? Was he this? Was he that? But everybody, males, females, everybody loved him because he had that Brazilian sense of style, charisma, look, appearance, his attitude, how he went out with things. And yet at the same time, how professional he was. You cannot imagine. He'd be the last person in the motorhome or in the paddock at night going through each and every detail of the car. And he'd walk out of the motorhome and go and he said, "Well, what do you think about this?" And remember, I only had him for a very, very, very short time. But if you ask any of the people at McLaren, or even at Lotus when he went there, or to Tolman. They will all tell you that no one ever dissected a car as much as he did before the race. And to think of what happened in Imola and his sad death was exactly as out of him. Well, that's my opinion. I don't want to stick my neck out here, but, you know, the steering column seemed to be broken. We don't know the full extent of the situation, but he had that altered the night before. And one of the things, don't let me get into all the technologies about welding and making sure that, look, it doesn't matter. The point is that he asked his team to change something, and it was some of the belief that caused the accident. It may not be the full answer, but, you know, Ayrton Senna was like that. He was adored, and revered. Even to this day, most people will say that he was their favourite driver. They may not say he was the quickest driver, but, you know, there's an argument to support that too. And so, overall, a wonderful person for motor racing. I think he did so many things. Only when you go to Sao Paulo and you realise the size of that funeral was just out of this world. You know, millions of people lining the place. And, of course, the biggest avenue, the big, big, big long street all the way from the centre of Sao Paulo to the airport is called Ayrton Senna Avenue. And rightly so. He is still, he's a god there, no doubt about it.
On the business front, Eddie, you didn't go into racing a rich man. Is it through racing you have amassed your fortune?
Well, I think, you know, no doubt about it, I've made money out of motor racing. Of course I did. And, you know, but not out of the racing team in terms of, I made it in selling the team, so I sold well. But that's the whole thing, the essence of business, isn't it? Knowing when to go in and go out of anything, no matter what it is, whether it's business, a relationship, or anything. Mm. So I've been lucky in that, selling the drivers. Where I was different, no other Formula One team, or any other team for that matter, in Formula 3 or 3000, they kind of took in a driver, you drive the car, adios. You're gone at the end of the season or whatever it is, contracted. I was very different to that. So when people started with me, whether it was Brundle, and then very soon after that, Ralf Schumacher and Frentzen, Irvine, Barrichello, and even Kenny Acheson, of course, and I sent them to Japan because there was a Formula 2 series where they paid decent money. And so these guys were all earning a couple of hundred grand at a time. But, you know, I was getting paid 10% out of each contract that I had arranged or contracted. So I was making some money, and that money was helping me to keep the Formula 1 team, or the Formula 4 team and the Formula 3 team. So these were all junior days. And it was only until, really, it was only until about 86 when we started to look like winning championships. And the first person, and I made a very big call. I moved from Toyota to Volkswagen, and Johnny Herbert, myself, and Jordan team won the prestigious Formula 3 championship. And that was a Kickstarter. And then I immediately sold him to Benetton. And he still remains to this day the only driver that Benetton has sacked twice. But, you know, he has won the French, he won the British Grand Prix. I'll never forget it. And it was, you know, remarkable. But when he had broken his legs with me, the guy shouldn't have been driving at all. He was so lucky in himself. And he, like me, he's on the other channel, on the BBC channel. He's on the Sky channel. But it's funny how most of my old drivers seem to crop up in all sorts of, because they learned an attitude. It wasn't just about driving the car. You have to prepare yourself for life thereafter. And so I have a concern about so many sports people that, considering what they're doing is so exciting at the time, but as soon as the curtain comes down, hey, what do we do next? What do I do about my investment? Where is the investment? Who have I given this to? Do I trust them? Is there a return in it? How am I going to live for the next 30, 40 years of my life? And is it going to be enough to do that? Or how should I do? So that's why I encourage all my people to find other opportunities. Irvine has his. Damon Hill has his. In the media, Johnny Herbert and Martin Brundle and a whole host of different guys. And I think that was the Jordan ethos. And that is, have great fun. Enjoy every moment of your life. but make sure you work your nuts off. I mean, it's a philosophy that I learned when I was growing up in Dublin. It was something my mother absolutely instilled in me. I suppose going to a school like Sing Street, where you got kind of battered from time to time, it also made you realize that, hey, we're in this to enjoy ourselves. We're in it to have fun. We are so fortunate to be in the position that we're in, but we have an obligation to provide for everybody going forward for the duration of our time on this planet.
You mentioned earlier on that you mightn't necessarily born in 1948 have been full of confidence. It wasn't the Irish way. It probably wasn't the Christian Brothers way. Did you resent Ireland? Do you remember thinking, I can't wait to get away from here? Did you feel it was a backward place at the time?
That thought was never in my mind. Even to this day, I'm ridiculously proud of the Irish context. And, you know, I married a Dublin girl some 40 odd years ago. And our eldest girl, Zoe, who was, we call her Biddy because she's the pride of the Coombe. And so she was born in the Coombe, and we don't let her forget that. She doesn't want to forget it. And she's so proud in terms, she's a wonderful designer, clothes designer. Most people know who Zoe Jordan is, certainly on the girl's side. And so she's picked that up. And the same thing is our children, for whatever reason, they wanted to go to university in Ireland, and they did. And they all have Irish passports, their mum and dad, even though some, yeah, weren't born there. But there's a huge connection with Ireland. I grew up playing the spoons, the baron, and then graduated to drums. So in other words, the music side comes from Ireland too. And we are very fortunate as a small nation to have, you know, the expertise and the people. Sometimes we don't give ourselves enough credit to realize what talent there is around the place. And that comes back to my own argument, which I was saying. I was brought up with this inferiority complex, or I felt I had. I felt that anyone, you know, in my young days, 10, 11, 12, if there was somebody speaking with an English accent, I always felt, they're more clever than me, or they have a better chance. Or, you know, for example, in those days, I was being brought up in Bray, and it was before English people went off to Spain on their holidays. They come to Bray as part of their annual holidays, and you hear an English voice, and suddenly you're going crazy about trying to introduce yourself to whatever girls who had this very, very funny English accent. But, you know, you grow up from there, and then you go and you realize that you mix globally, and you, particularly motor racing or anything, you're very much on your own. And when I was in Marlborough, you know, doing a series in Australia or in New Zealand and then in South America, you become very international very quickly. And I think it's very important that if people want to move, if they want to travel, and the education value out of travel and seeing other aspects of life, very often it's equivalent, if not better in some respects, to massive university degrees. It's being able to infiltrate, it's being able to understand, it's being able to grasp the other things that are important in life or that seem important in life, but never losing the fact where your roots are. And your roots, in my case, was Dublin, Bray, Sing Street, all of that kind of carry on. I worked in the bank for a while. I was quite a late starter into motor racing, so I was in a way quite fortunate, because I had learned about the financial aspect. So there was a certain amount of understanding. There was a confidence level there, which I wouldn't have had if I'd gone straight in as an 18 or a 16, like Lewis Hamilton as a 7-year-old kid into Formula One or into motor racing. So I never had that. So where I was quite fortunate, I understand and did understand the fiscal and the financial obligations and how structures work, and I could read a P&L, so this sort of thing. Though they were important in latter years, but not at the time of the race.
I was reading your father was religious. He would go on the occasional retreat for a time. You even thought you might have had a calling to the priesthood. Where does religion feature in your life now?
Well, wow. We have conflict inside our own house here with the kids. I believe in God. I really do. I'm not sure how strong that belief is with the rest of the family, but you'll have to ask that. That's a separate issue. You know, it was a tough time. I went to a school that my father thought that was important for me to knock the rough edges off me. And certainly knocking rough edges. You went to Sing Street and you survived Sing Street. There wasn't many edges on you by the time you came out of there. And but I don't think I could have ever have been the person that I got to, or with the commitment, the desire and the passion to achieve what I wanted to achieve or what I felt I needed to achieve. I couldn't have had that without the inspiration of the Christian Brothers. So there's a lot of people saying negative things about education and past history and stuff, and I'm sure some of those stories are horrific. I was never confronted with that situation, and I can only speak well of the time that I had at school. I enjoyed it. It was tough. Did I get hammered? Absolutely beaten. But, you know, was that an issue now? No, not at all. I want my children to go through it. You know, in some respects, it wasn't necessarily a bad thing. However, on reflection, I must say that, of course, it cannot be tolerated in any shape or form nowadays. But we had to go. I had to grow through it. I wouldn't want anyone else to you know, physical abuse, or not so much abuse, but if you didn't do your homework and you hadn't got it right, and you know, you got a couple of biffs and you made sure that you did your homework well because you didn't want to get the biffs, and it hurt you. So in a way it was a deterrent, and we know about what the world thinks about deterrence going forward. I mean, all sorts of things, whether the military deterrence or all sorts of things. But school, and where I went to school, there was a deterrent, and that was that you would be punished if you didn't get the right results and the right. And I think it's indicative. If you look at somewhere like Sing Street, the amount of people who were successful as a result of being there, and your own business, for example, the media. I mean, it was just like it was knocking out people who were always brilliantly talented in that particular field. And so I've only got good things to say about Sing Street. And you know, you asked about believing in God. Yes, I do.
And is it like, so, I mean, you're talking to someone who can't, I would love to believe, I'd love to have that crutch, can't bring myself there. Would you pray? Would you talk to God? Is it a huge comfort for you? Is it a daily thing for you?
You know, absolutely none of those things apply as such. But if I'm doing, where I think is important, right now, I'm not saying I'm stuck here, but at the moment I'm in Cape Town. And do I have a concern about, you know, like Brazil, because I've seen firsthand what the favelas are like. I've seen what the townships are like. And do I understand the concerns about lockdowns in environments like this? So do I think about God? Sometimes I think about God and I say, my God, why did he do that? I mean, that wasn't Christian. That wasn't what we'd expect to see or to hear. So there's always a bit of a conflict going on in my head. And do I talk to God on a daily basis? No, I would say that's absolutely not. But do I think about doing good? Do I think about what would my parents, what would my parents think that I was doing? Was I doing them proud? Was I doing the right thing for our fellow man, for a fellow Irishman, for a fellow Dubliner, for whatever, whether it's from school or not? And then you enlarge that into greater things. And that's what I want my children to have. And that is, whatever you do, whether you believe in God, you don't believe in God, that is a private thing. But what you must do is think about your fellow man. And you have to think about making sure that you do the best you can in the circumstances with the cards that you've been dealt with. If you have a really lucky opportunity, you know, that's why I have great admiration for people like Bill Gates, who is able to give. I mean, giving is such a wonderful thing, and I want to be like that. And I want to be able to give more. I've had, as I already talked about, you know, a lucky set of circumstances, but I don't want to be an easy target for every charity that's out there. I have to need and find my own ones that I feel very close to.
Mm. Are you chained to your desk and your phone and your email? Are you working as hard as ever, or has age changed all that for you?
Well, I've given up a couple of things. I was on the board of Citibank, and I thought that was just one step too much. I'm still working and doing some just on Zoom and what we're doing here with Oyster Yachts, because I'm passionate about my sailing. And I was asked to join the board when they got into some difficulty about 3-4 years ago. And thankfully, they're back on the road again. Whether I continue with that on a longer term basis, who knows? But yes, I am. I'm busy, which is hugely important to me. But I make myself busy. And things, for example, I still write for Boat International, and I have a column that I have to do after this. Because I sail around the world, I just wanted to do that. Because being brought up in Dublin and in Bray, you were sort of never far from the sea. And I had that love affair with the sea. And I always felt that when I was so stressed, both financially, mentally, in every way, with motor racing and the pressure to put on you, that the only real release I had was being on a boat, whereas I could turn off the phones and not listen to anyone either on the emails, to make sure that you know, nobody knew what the sat phone was on the boat. So I would make sure that it was only when I wanted to make contact or when I wanted to speak to somebody that I was in control of that, not the other way around. So yeah. Am I working? I'm working as much as I want to work, and you know, I still have dabbles. I mean, I probably spent a half an hour trading stocks this morning, because I for me it's a form of enjoyment. Some people might call it gambling, but yes, I punt on shares, because for me there's no football to punt on, and there's no anything, so much will punt on the stocks. And as we speak, we've had a couple of little touches, and so I'm chippy at the moment, and I'm enjoying it.
To round this off, because I've taken enough of your time, those 14 years with Jordan, and then the previous 10, I suppose, when you were in F3 and F3000, is that the most exciting, the best period of your life, or is it just so connected to stress that you're kind of happy to be out of it? Like, would you love to still be involved? Where are you in terms of your relationship with all that?
Would I like to be involved? Let's take a whole lot of questions in there. Sure. Would I like to be still involved? No. Okay. In fact, I have, it's like this thing, as I said to you very early on, it's about a vision. I think I've moved on from there, but I feel I owe the sport some respect and gratitude that I have for the sport. So therefore, I'll never leave that, lose that. So that's the first thing. Would I say the best part of my life? I often say, what was the best thing that I think I ever did in those days? What was the best success? What was the best thing that gave me the best satisfaction? Actually, nothing to do with racing, nothing to do with winning. The biggest satisfaction I ever had was to survive it. Because Formula One is not an easy thing to survive. There are so many piranhas out there that want to absolutely screw you down. And that's what happened. So I was a bit brutal, a bit callous. And I think you had to be a very tough, you had to get a lot of tough skin. And I became quite brutal. And I'm glad I've, over time, hopefully, I've lost a bit of that now, because it was exasperating times in terms of the frustrations of various different things that people don't really understand or realize, and you wouldn't want them to understand, but they are there as a one-man team, and you don't have the support of your Toyotas or your Hondas or your Mercedes, your Ferraris and BMWs and Mercedes and all of these different people, which most of the teams now have. So we did it on our own, and that probably has given me the biggest satisfaction. And the thing, when I reflect, I say the fact that I survived it. If we talk about the, you know, so the survival of the business was the biggest important thing. On reflection, what gave me the best pleasure? For sure, the years in Formula 3 and 3000. We won a lot. Nobody, even to this day, no one has ever won as many Formula 3 races or 3000 races as we did. And you know, on reflection, and the great drivers that we brought along, I remember winning Le Mans with Jean Alesi, then going to Pau, and he was a really, really difficult person. He got sacked from his previous team. I needed a driver, and he was just so annoying that I insisted that he came to live with us in Oxford, and he did and stayed there, and then we couldn't get rid of him. But you know what was nice, because Mickey, our second girl, she went off to Sauveterre to go to school in Avignon, where Jean is from. And so the Alesi family and the Jordan family would be hugely linked. And whilst I can tell you a little story about the two important people that were important to me. And whilst we're talking about Jean Alesi, I think it's important. He was the one, when he won the championship, I got him a drive at the French Grand Prix in Formula One material. And during that time, Michele Alboreto had hurt himself and his teammate was Jonathan Palmer. And I remember Ken Tyrrell saying to me, I don't know how you've wangled this with Camel, but anyway, we've got this guy. Do you realise he's probably not going to qualify? I said, Ken, you leave that to me. I feel I'm confident knowing where this Sean is going to be. And he said, well, he's got to learn as much as he can from Palmer. So as much as I like Jonathan, I just said nothing. So I let it happen. And of course, Sean finished fourth. And Ken Tyrrell, within half an hour, wanted a new contract, wanted to sign him forever. And in actual fact, he did sign him for a year. But Jean became a real star, as you know, because he was that kind of person, very Latin in his attitude. But he, more than anyone, was the guy. Eddie, I've seen what happened to Tyrrell. I've seen now firsthand what happens because he went from there to Ferrari. You must immediately take on and have a crack at Formula One, because your team, the way it's structured, the way it's presented, how you approach your racing, how you actually have the mindset, you've got to give it a crack. And of course, I was desperate to do that, but I realized that, yes, I'd made some reasonable money in the different categories prior to that. Was I prepared to risk it all? And I remember talking to Marie. I said, Marie, and her, I'll never forget it. She said, look, you're never going to be happy if you don't have a crack at it. And you're never going to be happy if you don't give it your all. And I said, well, what happens if we blow all this money that I'm going to put into it? You know, I'd made 5 million. And I mean, that was at the end of the 80s. That was a lot of money then. It's a lot of money now. But, you know, the fact is I didn't even give it a second thought. And once Marie said to me, well, look, we'd only be back to where we were back in the late 70s when we were in Dublin and just got married and we hadn't got a care in the world, but we didn't have a bob in our pants. So, you know, we were difficult, but I got great encouragement all the way through. So that was Jean Alesi. And the second person who I think, just before we finish up on this, was when I was a driver in Ireland and I got the chance to go and join the Mobile World Championship team as one of the juniors. And in that team, there was James Hunt, there was Niki Lauda, Emerson Fittipaldi, and the person who joined more or less at the same time with me was Alan Prost. And that's why we talked about Alan so affectionately earlier on in the program. So the thing is, Niki Lauda said to me, he said, Eddie, we're similar age. You started late in this business. My advice to you, you're a very good driver, very talented, but you're not material to win a world championship. And please remember, there was James Hunt, there was Niki and Emerson, and Prost. Between them, they probably had won about 15, 16 world championships. So I took this to heart, and it sort of hurt me, but maybe I said, well, let's get some value out of this conversation. And he said, if you start a young team and create a situation where you will dedicate the team to bringing on young drivers and making sure they make the next step thereafter, not alone it'll be good for you, it'll be good for your mind, good for your pocket in terms of profitability, and it'll also be good for your soul. And so that's the encouragement that Niki gave me. That's why, you know, when I'm doing my rock and roll, I always do a song, With or Without You, which is a U2 song, and that is my little message to Niki, that it was him who helped me to put that in place. And I'll never forget him for that, because
that's a Freudian slip. Freudian slip there.
Freudian slip it may be. Anyway.
Very last question. Is Formula One in a good place?
I'm not sure. You know, I'm probably not close enough. Now, you think that maybe I should be with working with the TV and stuff, but I work with guys who are very talented, you know, in a little group that we go from race to race. On my side, I work with Mark Webber and David Coulthard. And then there's Martin Brundle, Johnny Herbert and Damon Hill. So there's a group of us who kind of eat out together, even though we're split into two camps. One is Sky, one is Channel 4 BBC. I think Formula One is in a confusing state. I'm a huge Bernie Eccleston fan, and we talked about people with vision and with the foresight and the understanding with the belief. And he became, you know, he was a trawler worker's son, and he grew and still growing. I had a text from him the other day because I had to send him a congratulations. He's expecting yet another child at the age of 90. I mean, just bizarre. But anyway, I leave him to all that sort of stuff. But the reality is that I think that Bernie did the most remarkable thing for a minority sport to build it into what he did. And I remember him saying to us team owners, he said, right, guys, Eddie, I want you, because he'd allocate different jobs to different people. I want you to go and look after this new race that I want to put on in China. I said, Bernie, China, Formula One, are you mad? And then, of course, he came up with Bahrain and various other new circuits that people never really expected. Remember, this was a European-type sport. It was the equivalent to Champions League. It wasn't the World Cup. But now it is the World Cup. And, you know, there's new races in Vietnam. There's China. There's Australia. There's Abu Dhabi. And, you know, forget just Monaco and Silverstone. There's just so many races everywhere. And I think there's too many races. Because I have always had a belief that less is more. And if you do the really, really fine detail and make sure you capitalize and get the best out of every situation, then you don't need to have a race every weekend or, you know, 22 races a year. It's just far, far too much. It puts huge stress on the teams, financial stress, the parts, the equipment. And then you have to think about the travel and you have to really think about the people. Now, I think that a lot of sports where there's huge traveling involved may have to reassess where we're going to long term, because it's not just this virus that's going to come into play, but it's also different people's aspect of life. And we've had a couple of fatalities this year in Formula One, where we've had the vein thrombosis and various things, you know, through extensive travel. I just think that we need to just relax a bit and be a little bit more focused. I don't think we need to be going to every aspect and every little corner of the globe just to make money for the people who own it. I think we need to go back to being a miracle race and a miracle form of sport to be able to watch, enjoy, and without ramming it down our neck. And I just think we have too many races.
Okay. Listen, I've taken enough of your time. Golden Mondello is the documentary that you were on to promote, and it's on YouTube. If you search Golden Mondello, you'll get it there. Eddie Jordan, stay safe over the next few months, and hopefully things get back to normal semi-soon. Thanks so much for this.
Listen, I'm pleased to be on the ball, or off the ball. one of my favourite pieces is Roy Keane, and listening to him on with you guys some time ago. And all the different people that you get on the show. I love it and I'm very proud, very happy to be part of it. Thank you.
Thanks, Eddie.